The hour of 8 a.m. having arrived, I am going to call to order the Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. Members, we're going to continue at the beginning with our look at legislative reform. We have had MCSL with Brenda Erickson in the Revisor's Office. Now we're going to have House Research do a presentation. Immediately following this, we will take up the pensions bill, and then immediately following the pensions bill, we'll be going into a conference committee on one of the elections bills. So we have a lot to do before 10:30, and with that, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Patrick McCormick. I'm director of the House Research Department.
Proceed.
Before I came down to testify today, I looked at my job description and I couldn't find anywhere where it said that I was supposed to criticize the 134 sitting members of the House. But I did find a few old pieces of work that I have done in the past on legislative reform, and they tend to cover the Minnesota legislature over the last 30 years, and that's going to be the context of my remarks today. I hope to provide a little bit of perspective about how this legislature has changed, because I think that these changes are affecting and perhaps maybe afflicting the Minnesota legislature, and they are of a long-term nature. So first I want to note that in a past life I worked for the Senate, and I have now worked for the House, and I never make invidious comparisons between the two. But I want to note that we at House Research are genuinely happy to work for the House. We think we do a pretty good job. We understand the House. We want to make it the best body within the best legislature within these 50 states. Second thing I want to note is that I think the spokesperson from the MCSL has done a great job talking about how time is the lost commodity at the legislature. I think it's worth listening closely as we hear how other legislatures deal with this problem. Typically, Minnesota has adopted sort of a hostile attitude toward any discussion of how other states work, and I think that's a mistake. I would argue that that's a self-defeating way of thinking about these things. We can learn from other states. I read a recent MCSL article that categorized the states, and in the context of it's always good to see how people talk about you. They discussed Minnesota as what they call a white state. They classify things into the red, white, and blue states. A red state is a state that is very much like Congress. Large staff, members who are paid over $70,000 a year, large districts. A blue state is a completely part-time legislature. Members may make $2,000 to $5,000 a year. They have very few staff members. They meet very seldom. In some senses, the white states, those states in the middle, like Minnesota, have the hardest time constructing rules and operational procedures. They live on the border between a full-time and a part-time legislature. The Minnesota legislature has changed a great deal over the past 30 years. Many of these changes have been focused on openness in government and not focused on efficiency of legislative action. In the 1960s and 1970s, the openness movement included arguments that committee hearings needed to be open to the public, that decisions needed to be made in official meetings, that too much of the legislative process was pre-cooked in private meetings. Legislatures nationally were coming out of an era where government happened in side rooms and public notice was scant at best. In the 1980s, the Minnesota legislature wanted to study how they might improve their work product. They funded a study at the Humphrey Institute. I worked as a junior staffer on that study. It looked at the Minnesota legislature and it recommended a slew of structural reforms, higher pay for members, annual budget cycles, structural changes in how the budget was created. For my part, I studied conference committees. Minnesota, then and now, uses conference committees more than almost any legislature. Our rules do not allow round-robin referrals from floor to floor. We operate in parallel independently between the House and Senate. We don't have joint committee staff. We don't have joint committees. Often a member who has a co-author in the other body may not meet with their co-author until the end of session. And our culture accepts readily the concept that a bill will end up in conference committee. Although this 1980 study was funded in part by the legislature, it was not owned and not implemented by the legislature in the end. As I ponder my experience with that study, a few things have become clear to me. It is not absolutely important what academics or staff or the media think about the legislative process. It is very important what the public thinks. And this has been a major impetus over the last 30 years for the openness in government movement and many of the ways in which we keep the process open to the public. But it is absolutely crucial in the end that members engage in the change and create the legislature they want. This is in part a constitutional duty. The Minnesota Constitution says in Article 4 that each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, sit upon its adjournment, etc. You've all heard that constitutional section. The Constitution allows the members to design the legislative process. If you want legislative reform, my advice is to get the legislature involved, or it takes the legislature to change the legislature. But it is also very clear that the legislature exists within a larger society, and we are not immune to change that is forced on us by the outside forces of that society. And that's a good segue, because I'm going to be talking about technology and cell phones in a minute. Here are some simple inventions that have required industry to shift, in the industrial world to shift, what they do in business. Cell phones, software, word processing, inventory tracking, email, copy machines, PDF files, television cameras, audio recordings of hearings. When I started working, I was given a typewriter and told to type my memos. Recently, on a bill before the House of Representatives, I did 38 amendments in 3 hours. I could not have done 38 amendments in 3 hours when I started this job on a typewriter. But I have done that many more than once since I started as Director of House Research. And as Director, I am not one of the major amendment producers in our shop. I'm not a Mark Shepard.
I want to interrupt you on the 38 sure. amendments for a second.
Sure.
Yesterday in Finance, we had a bill up dealing with car standards. Mm-hmm. There was an amendment. It was 2 pages. And we had to recess to have it drawn up. When the amendment came down, there were at least a couple of errors, wordsmithing errors, that were significant. In the there were 2 problems. One was that you were very busy, and the other was that even copying it was difficult, so we were in recess for over an hour. When you say you did 38 amendments, in what was the period of time?
3 hours.
3 hours? If that type of stress is put on you, what's the likelihood of simple errors, grammatical errors, or any other type of errors? And I'm not even talking about substantive errors.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to talk about my own personal errors, and I make a number of them. And when I do 38 amendments in 3 hours, I don't know what errors I might have made. I have a sinking feeling as that paper flow goes out the door that I wish I could review it. And so I avidly check for my errors the next day. That's not how I like to do business. The likelihood of my errors goes way up, and that's because I'm trying to meet the needs of the committee or the floor.
Mr. McCoy, I'm not blaming you.
No,
for the,
I agree.
I'm blaming us for putting the stress on you to have to do 38 amendments in 3 hours, or to do a rather complicated amendment in a short period of time to a very complicated bill. Representative Peterson.
Thank you. On those 38 amendments in 3 hours, I'm assuming that was on the House floor. And I'm assuming that most of those amendments are usurping the committee process. I mean, is the text of many of those amendments something that's never been brought up in committee? Is new introductions or new ideas to the bill?
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, the answer is some yes and some no. You can do a very simple delete a section number three. That's fine. That's completely germane. You can say, take House File 2200 and amend it into House File 2201 on the floor. That may never have been considered in committee. So it's a mix.
Again, as a new person to the process, I'm concerned on the House floor that when we see amendments, even in the legislature, we've taken on the role of insurgency as a word we've learned from the war in Iraq. Am I wrong that amendment process on the House floor, in my opinion, is more insurgency than it is constructive or of any redeeming value?
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair,
maybe you don't want to answer.
I'm gonna circle in my presentation on that very point, but I'm gonna come at it from a different direction.
Okay, thanks.
Proceed, Mr.
I just want to talk about another simple change, which is that this is one of my staffers was telling me that when she started, the only way to listen to the House floor was to have your phone up to your ears and listen to the House floor proceedings, and people would call her to get amendments and they couldn't because she was on her phone. And now you can have TV boxes, emails, and as you're drafting these 38 amendments, emails can come in asking for the 39th amendment or the 40th amendment, and so you're constantly communication linked. I want to talk about how staff work in this new environment. The work of a legislative staffer is to be of service to members. We try to serve all members confidentially. Partisan staff serve their caucus members within the light of what their caucus wants. All the staff, partisan, nonpartisan, really have one guiding principle. We want to help get the job done right. So we leave each day with a good feeling if we set the table. If we've written the legislation, done the memos, drafted the bill, organized the hearing, or simply picked up the loose papers in the hall after the meeting. But we leave happiest if we've added value to the process, if we've communicated to you the right legal and policy background that you need to make the decisions in front of you. There have been two forces of late that have hampered the ability of staff to do things particularly well. I'm arguing that one is technology. Technology is our great friend. It allows us to do all the things that were impossible a long time ago when there were a few actual copies of bills. But technology robs us of time. And time is necessary for thought, consideration, care, and quality. The other force, I would argue, is the budget. The overlapping of budgetary responsibilities and budget setting in the time that once was set aside for policy review, policy bills. As a legislative staffer, I naturally am partisan in believing that the budget timelines are all whacked in the favor of the governor. And in a way that pushes the legislature to the back end of the process and clutters the legislative agenda. And sometimes we blame ourselves for the legislative budgetary process. The solution might lie in negotiating better executive legislative budget processes. I want to say that what technology takes away, what the budget process takes away, new rules and laws and organization can give back. A member, when elected, typically comes here to get things done. But the Constitution also tells us that members are sent here to govern this body and have the right to change how this body works. And in fact, it's a constitutional duty. As a young man in the 1980s, when we came up with all these ideas, we made a crucial error of working for the legislature but not in engaging the leadership of the legislature in the changes. And what I'm telling you today is that legislators themselves have to guide and direct the changes of the organization, and that anybody else with an opinion can help feed you ideas. When a bill is introduced, and there have been 4,200 bills this biennium, about 1,800 more per biennium than was the case 15 years ago, that bill has been touched by several hands. The author thought up the idea, or the agency bought it to the author, or a member of the public bought it to the author. A staff member wrote memos and background pieces, or drafted the bill. The support staff organized and fit the bill into correct templates. The revisor matched the bill with statutes and certified the quality of the work. When a bill is amended, the same process is supposed to occur in miniature. but this makes it sound too clean. Along the way, people talked the idea over, gotten the idea expressed in policy terms, in human language, in statutory and budget language. This involves that most rare and useful of tasks of procedures, talking to each other. Along the way, specialists have to fit the idea into existing structures. How does this interact with the Commerce Clause? Existing characters of tax laws, the stated policies of the governor, federal regulations. This is laborious. You can't just do this at your desk in 5 minutes. You have to take time looking at these other documents and the amendment in front of you. Along the way, you might have to take the issue and stand it on its head because the minority wants to attack the idea, because somebody in the industry comes up and says, we have an issue with how that's written. When I have a staff member retire, we do an exit interview, and they all say the same thing. They lament that the legislature has changed during their tenure. Less emphasis on research, less time for analysis, less time to go through all of these steps, to talk to people, analyze other laws, to fit things together. When the amendment came down with errors, Mr. Chair, I can also tell you that the staff who did the amendment probably tried as hard as they could, but they probably didn't have time to look at the Commerce Clause or other laws from other states or to play with the idea for 5 minutes to think it through.
Mr. McCarrick, I'm going to just stay with the amendments for a second.
Sure.
There's been discussion when we had Ms. Erickson here, and then subsequent discussion with the Chief Clerk's Office about the use of technology and going to the issue of amendments, that if there were a rule that all amendments had to be posted 24 hours in advance, that then at least the public would be able to see the amendments. The amendments would then have some vetting. I mean, there would be the ability to take a look at them and say, common error should be corrected. I'm not advocating that that's going to be a recommendation of what we finally come through, but there's been great discussion among all of us about the amendment issue. When you're doing 38 amendments in 3 hours, one person is doing 38. When we have an amendment come down yesterday, and it's because we pushed staff to the brink, and there are significant errors in it, that's not good policy on anyone's part. So this is a two-part question about posting these 24 hours in advance. And then the other question would be, there seems to be here a flaw that there is not time to double check. There was, when I first came to the legislature, not at least this horde of amendments, and that there was the ability to double check. And I'm not just talking amendments now, but that when the conference committee report was finished, before that report would come to the floor, there was the ability to double or triple check the report to ensure that what was in the report. So this is a two-part question. Would you find it useful to have the amendments posted 24 hours in advance? And then would there be a recommendation about having you, giving you the time to double check?
I'm going to give you a two-part answer. yes, I think that posting in general, and there are a lot of different rules in different legislatures about how the posting requirements would be structured, would help. Because it would allow people to see, it would allow errors to be checked, it would allow members of the public to take a look at it and find errors for us, and it would allow us to come up, have a good night's sleep, come in the next morning and say, I'm going to have to make some technical changes in the A33 amendment. So I think in general that would help. One of the scariest things that I heard from the reviser is something that she probably did not underline as hard as I would have. And she talked about how in the last 3 days of the legislative session over the last several years, many of these big bills have not been proofed by her staff because there hasn't been the time to proof those big bills. And that makes entire common sense. If you cut a deal on the last Saturday of this session at noon, and then hear that bill later that night at 4 a.m. copy time, just the time the copy machines have to run, is going to be a long time. And the reviser will do a miracle for you, but that miracle will require the reviser to reduce or eliminate the amount of time they spend proofing. And proofing is something that is boring and dry and happens out of sight of the members, but that is part of quality control. It's part of what we as staff struggle to deliver to you. So when you compress time, our natural bias is to use that compression to give you more time to deliberate, more time to think things through. We give up the time to proof. We don't like to. And I think that the quality of what comes out is reduced. Now, other legislatures handle this different. Some people have a fourth reading, where after the bill has passed substantively, it's reviewed for errors. And then only technical changes are made on fourth reading. I think that our NCSL representative did a great job of outlining the different rules. But I think that this is an increasing problem. I want to talk about House File 1812 for a minute in this vein to determine if I can.
Please do.
a total of 187 amendments were prepared by our office for House File 1812.
How many?
187.
187.
An additional 81 were prepared by the advisor. That's 247 amendments prepared for one bill.
Representative Pat.
Just one question. Was that in the preparation of it or on the floor?
This was
Mr. McCormick.
This is Chair Representative Pat. This was in the from day one on the bill through the floor. I would say about 50% of these were floor amendments. If you gave each amendment 10 minutes of debate, that would require 2,700 minutes of debate. If 60% of these were floor amendments, that would require about 30 hours of debate. It's entirely possible for the House Research Department and the revisor to create far more than 300 amendments. We could do 400. We can email them directly to the printer. We can use wireless in the committee rooms, modify existing amendments, upload past bills into amendment form. I see no reason why we could not do 600 amendments. I'm saying that we could probably do 1,000 amendments.
Chairman, I would delete...
Representative Kahn.
I would delete that section from the tape. Can we move that?
Representative Kahn, no, I think we'd like to make sure that the public can hear what we're capable of doing to them. Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, when I had a typewriter, I could not do 38 amendments. My office could not do 300 amendments. The change in technology is going to force you to think about how this process works. That's, a nonpartisan, neutral statement.
Representative Wolfiger has a question.
Chair members, I was in tax committee until 8:15 last night, got home about 9:30, and there was a letter from a constituent about an amendment from House File 1812, and she was outraged about some vote I had taken on an amendment, which I've since found out was stripped out. So, I mean, this is what's happening to members as well about, you know, technology, numbers of amendments. People get one email about an issue that's long gone or long past. But, I mean, it truly, and I've heard this said before, so it's not my words, but it truly feels like it's the wild, wild west on the House chamber floor. And it's not comforting to me, and I don't think it's comforting to the public either. So I appreciate the honesty.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. McCormick, your comments on this are very helpful. One of the concerns that I have, though, too, and it's tied into just House research and the burden that's placed on them, is just overall and the committee side of the process and how much time members are given to read a bill that's maybe 200 pages long before it comes to the committee, and then they're supposed to offer amendments. And I think a lot of times what we're seeing is not enough time is given in the committee side, so then all of these amendments get pushed to the House floor as people are scrambling to look at a bill like this. Or, you know, there's been situations where we've had to read all amendments on the House floor. Well, that changes the whole dynamic of what bill we're looking at overall. And hopefully we can spend some time just kind of looking at that and seeing what other states do to try and make sure that we fully utilize the committee process. I know, Mr. Chair, you've talked about that and the concerns that you've had with that, too. And but I just, you know, just recently I one of the committees that I serve on, I had an example where, you know, we were given the bill, we got the walkthrough, the very next day we're doing the markup of the bill, and it was a significant changes and didn't give us a whole lot of time to give thought to this as legislators. And then when I went and talked to some of the House researchers about some of the provisions in the bill, they said, well, we don't have the complete data on this. We're waiting to get it. And so they were feeling nervous, and I could see that they were apprehensive because they couldn't necessarily fully explain it to me and feel that the language that they drafted maybe won't truly get at the what it was supposed to be solving. And so, I mean, that's alarming to me as well, is that we just aren't utilizing the committee process. We aren't giving members enough time to look at some of these things, and hopefully we can find a way to fix that.
Representative Anderson, remember, we will be using this standing committee to make recommendations for the next legislature. So that's the intent of having these hearings, and then the follow-up will be the discussion to your point and recommendations for whoever is in charge in 09. Representative Peterson.
Thank you. It's merely a comment, going back to my question of Mr. McCormick earlier about the style, i.e. Insurgency. And 1812 is a great poster child. You know, that's an overture is written by Tchaikovsky. And the theme is when Napoleon was attacking Moscow, so the whole orchestra, bombs are dropping. Boom, boom. And Moscow still falls. So I think 1812 will be a great example of
Representative Representative Peterson, I prefer to look at it as Napoleon invading Russia with an overbloated army that is slaughtered and has to retreat back in the winter, and what's left of it isn't worth anything, and he loses his empire. And I think we're about to lose the legislative process the same way.
Not to be dramatic.
No.
Chairman,
Mr. McCormick.
I have other items at dinner, but I do want to make a closing point. I read with great respect the memo that you received from Jack Davies, who has some great thoughts on how legislature should be changed. But I always harken back to one of my mentors, John Randall. And John thinks as he speaks. He's one of those people who, in mid-sentence, is constructing the end of the sentence. But it's always worth waiting for. And when you're in the middle of a process with 53 amendments piled up behind, and when former member Brandel would speak, sometimes people would roll their eyes, but they would always stop and pay attention. And I note that the one problem with the Minnesota legislature is that now some thoughtful people who have something to say feel pressured by time, and they might look up and blame whoever's in front of them, the chairman, the majority leader, this week, the majority, the minority. And I know that technology is going to make us all more and more frustrated as the thoughtful people take that 5 minutes to speak. And I think that if you look at these reforms, you ought to think of, from a staff perspective, what we want to come out of this with is the ability to do value-added work, to make your work product better for you, to make sure you don't run into a committee and have someone say, well, you fooled, didn't you notice that the federal government just preempted that? We want to know that so we can tell you. But I think you as members should probably think about, how do I preserve that 5 minutes for that most thoughtful member who wants to talk on the busiest day of the year without pulling up the process, without the 85 bills behind them all making it say, come on, Mr. Randall, come on, Representative Randall, speak up, move along. If you can get that kind of reform that does both, I think you've done a great reform. Our office just wants to help you to determine you do anything you want to do.
Representative Brock.
First of all, Mr. McCormick, thank you. What you guys do is absolutely phenomenal, and I think most of the public doesn't actually see or even know about the mechanics that go on behind the scenes, so thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, when we think about the amendment process, we often blame the amendment, or which is the symptom of something bigger. And when we look at, I just got a notice at 8 last night about the bills that are actually coming up on the floor today, 16 bills. It's pretty hard to have a 24-hour amendment rule if you don't have people knowing what's coming up on the House floor. And so I don't know, you know, as we think about what's happening on the back end, on the floor, we've got to start adjusting how we communicate between the caucuses as well. And I think that that is a very important thing to talk about. And it's that delete all amendment that come out. And I'll just give you one example of a committee that we had. We had all of our House research made a huge effort in getting all of our amendments drafted, knowing that they were not going to work. They couldn't tell us because they have confidentiality, which I absolutely agree with and trust. But unfortunately, then they had to provide us all of that work for nothing, because what they knew was that the targets were going to change and box us in on the amendments the next day. So it's a procedural thing that starts from the committees and goes to the floor. And I hope, and I know, Mr. Chairman, that you won't do this, but I hope that we don't just look at what happens on the floor and that we look at what creates the need. Need is determined however you want to do it, determine it, but what creates the flurry on the floor. And also, Mr. Chairman, just to put it into perspective as well, when members are being asked to vote on bills that are 200-300 pages, for example, the end of last session, $26 billion in an hour and a half, you know, those are the things that I think we've got to really, really tack down, and I know that you are absolutely committed to doing that, so I thank you very much.
Representative Braun, in the hearings that we've had, we've taken a comprehensive look at every aspect of the legislative process, and I would hope that when we now go back to make recommendations, we do exactly what you said. Because it makes no sense to try to fix amendments if 16 bills are coming within 24 hours. There's no way you can post. And then the stress goes right back to here. Mm-hmm. So we'll be doing 247 amendments in what times, or you'll be doing 38. And even one amendment yesterday, a significant amendment to a significant bill, flawed, that improbably is still flawed, and we'll fix it on the House floor. That's our ultimate. We will fix it on the House floor. And that scenario simply cannot continue. Representative Todd, do you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, another area, and I'm not sure if you've covered this, is the lack of cooperation and coordination between the House and the Senate. You know, we can't call a senator by dialing six and four numbers. We can't, working on an amendment for a conference committee report with the senator yesterday, they couldn't work from the House version because, you know, some reason it had to be unlocked in some way that it wasn't unlocked after session and so forth, and it just seems that one technical system would be very helpful.
Representative Kennedy, there's been ongoing discussion about that, and remember that there have been two bodies in control here. We've come in now for the second year. There was intense discussion. We were in control prior to that about doing just this, and then we hit a rather large hole in our budget. 03-04. But you're right, that's something that has to be fixed. Anybody else have any other questions on this? Because we have one more person that wishes to testify, and then we're going to go to the pension bill. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering whether you could make available to some of us this report that you referenced from the 1980s.
Mr. McCormick?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I have a number of pieces of material which I'll share with the committee.
The members, just to represent Broad's point before she leaves, remember that when a new group takes over the legislature, both House Research and the Revisor's Office are ready and willing to help you put together rules, but they have to be asked. Just as a reminder, they don't come down and volunteer, they have to be asked. And we're asking them now for help. We have Phil Griffin, is he here? I know he wanted to testify, but he had something else today. He's not here. He is not here. So then we'll hold off on Mr. Griffin, and we will go to Representative Murphy, House File 3082. Where's Representative Murphy? Where did she go? We've lost everyone. This discussion has driven the people who wish to testify out of the room. Representative,
by a little bit of time and satisfy some curiosity, I'm wondering, do you contemplate having additional hearings before we adjourn Sunny Dice so that we'll discuss as a body here the recommendations, or is this something to be done?
Now, Representative Simon, we will have additional hearings given the time that we have left, but this standing committee will have hearings from now until
the next legislative session on this issue to produce a report that the next legislature can look at for suggestions of improvement. But we will do it through a standing committee of the Minnesota House. There will be no working group. There will be no listening group. It will be through a recorded standing committee. And with that, Representative Murphy, welcome to the committee. Representative Murphy, I understand that we have to send this to rules first because of deadlines, and then from rules it will probably have to go to finance. So I'm going to move that House File 3082 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Rules Committee. So the bill is before us, Representative Murphy.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is the first committee hearing for House File 3082 that is recommended by the Pension Commission for passage. It is a bill that provides stability for hundreds of thousands of Minnesota retirees and working people in state, local, and community governments.
Representative Murphy, excuse me one second. I believe I have to move an amendment to put your bill in order.
Mr. Chair, we have a printed amendment and we have an oral amendment that...
Representative Murphy, what I'm going to do first is move the 27A amendment, and that will put the bill in the base order. And if we get Mr. Shepard here... So, members, the 27A amendment is the amendment that is the core of the bill, and I'm going to move that first. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Murphy, you then have a 30A amendment.
That's correct.
Would you want to explain or have staff explain, Mr. Shepard, the 30A amendment?
Mr.
Martin, would you explain that?
Mr. Chair, it changes a date. To make something in the future rather than retroactive.
I'll move the 30A amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
And then, Representative Murphy, you said you had one other amendment. We prefer in this committee not to do oral amendments, but to have you tell us what the amendment is. Mr. Shepard will then write it out and give it to Mrs. Anderson so that we have the amendment in writing. So if you would do that.
Mr. Chair, I understand that this is an amendment that the reviser caught, and Mr. Martin can explain.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, members, I'm Larry Martin from the staff of the Pension Commission. The amendment is the change of one citation, one numeral. It's on page 11, line 35. Subdivision 1 on page 11, line 35 should be subdivision 2.
Mr. Shepard, we'll wait for a second and have Mr. Shepard find that.
Mr. Chair, yes, I do have that. I will write it up. As Mr. Martin said, page 11, line 35, the reference to 352.119 subdivision 1 should instead be to 359.119 subdivision 2.
Members, I'm going to move that amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Representative Murphy, I believe we have the bill in the order that you wish.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. As I said, this bill provides stability and fairness, and it influences the lives of hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans and people that work for state, local, or community governments, or county governments. And we have to be very careful as we make changes to the plans that they are depending on for their economic survival in their elder years. It is a great responsibility, and I think that this bill makes changes that, as I said, provide stability and ends some of the volatility that the stock market creates. And, Mr. Chair, I would like to go over through the bill very briefly to tell you what's in it. There are 17 articles, and that's a lot.
Representative Murphy, proceed.
Mr. Chair, Article 1 deals with the post-retirement investment fund, commonly called the post fund. and it establishes a plan for if we are successful, how it will be maintained. The Article 2 talks about if we are not successful, how we will dissolve it and put the post-fund funds back with the active funds. Minnesota is unique in all the countries by having the three major funds, MSRS, PERA, and PRA, mm-hmm. where their funds are divided into post-retired people and active retired people. How the money goes into the post fund is when a person selects retirement, then the money that they have contributed and has been accumulated in their name goes into the post fund with them. And so it's taken from one fund to the other fund. The other way that we get money is by smart investment. And so the retirement funds are created in that manner for the post fund. If we go under 80% investment return, then we would dissolve the fund and the assets and the posts would be in one fund. And that would, that combination then would give us better results.
Representative Murphy, just to remind the members, we had a hearing on this issue last year. It was one of the first hearings of this committee as a result of some rather interesting press that the retirement funds were getting at the time. And we did have several scenarios that were laid out before the committee. This was one of them. So just to remind members that a year ago, we did have a hearing. There were some scenarios that were proposed. This is one of the scenarios that was proposed to us. So, Representative Murphy.
Thank you for that addition, Mr. Chair, because this hasn't been thought of on the fly. This has been in the talking stage for over 4 years. And 3 years ago, they really started thinking, is this the way we should go? In the last year, they have had meetings across the state. They have had meetings at the retirement building, and hundreds of people have had input into this. And so the recipients, or the annuitants, and the active people have all been given good background on this. Article 3 is an article that deals with phased retirement, or how an individual can return to employment after they have retired. And the most, the 2 points that are most particular about this is that in accordance with federal law, a person would have to have a 30-day break. When they retired from state employment before they take up a new job. And the other part is that a person who is returning to a school district or in a different teaching position after they had retired from teaching would be able to earn up to $46,000. And the previous cap of how much they could earn was $36,560. And so that's the big change there. But it's a good plan because it allows people to still be contributors, at least part-time, and allows them to phase into full-time retirement, if that's the way they choose. Section 11 of the phased retirement article deals with the Metropolitan Police. It was a position of Metropolitan Airports Commission, Police Department, so that they could hire retired police officers for special occasions. Article 4 deals with a problem that seems to appear almost every year, where a spouse of an individual that retires did not know that they had chosen a certain retirement package. And so this Article 4 says that a spouse has to sign. There has to be proof to the spouse that they know of what kind of plan that their spouse is signing up for. Article 5 has some administrative provisions that deals with administrative changes for TRA, MSRS, and PERA. And there's a local provision in there for the Clearwater County Hotel and Hospital in Section 35. And it allows them to complete the privatization process, and that their employees will be able to continue to contribute to PERA. The Article 6 deals with two employment positions at MSRS correction plant, and this went through the process, and so it was recommended by the plan and by the department. Article 7 talks about it was a Mahoney provision in MSRS, and it allows legislators and constitutional officers to make the same kind of selection choice that state employees get to make at the end of 10 years or at the end of their first year in office. The Article 8 talks about PERA benefits following the privatizations in Wilmer and Worthington Regional Hospital. Article 9 talks about a redirection of state aid from first-class city teacher plan, and it reinstates the Duluth teachers into the aid allocation that was removed, that they were removed from in, I think, 2002, and it will reinstate them, and as of October 1st, 2009 payment. And that was the amendment that we made at the beginning, Mr. Chair. It redirects amortization date freed up after 2009, full funding of the local police and state fire relief associations that were merged into PERA and police and fire in 1999, and it just divides some money up, redirects some money to St. Paul teachers, Minneapolis teachers, or Minneapolis Relief Association, Duluth Pension, Police and Fire, and 40% of the reallocation goes to local volunteer firefighter organizations for their pensions. Article 10 talks about MINSCU and the IRAP, which is the Higher Educational Individual Retirement Account Plan, and it makes some changes. And Section 7 talks about an actuarial study to talk about that will tell us what the costs are if we allow certain individuals in IRAP to make a second chance choice. In recent years, we've had frequent requests that somebody be given, they didn't have enough information, or they came in at the wrong time of the year, and they weren't given the information by which they had to make selections, and so they didn't make the proper selections, so can they have a second chance? And this is a serious request, serious charge, but we have no idea how much it costs. And so we need to have that, and they are going to, TRA is going to do that study and make a report to us for next year. Article 11 talks about financial and actuarial reporting. It lowers the assumptions for the salary and payroll growth based on recent experience studies, and this should give us more accuracy in planning individual members' futures. And the section also, in Article 11, extends the amortization period for paying off unfunded liabilities to 2038 for PERA, police and fire, MSRS correction, and MSRS judges. And we provide for a rolling 25-year amortization period for the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Plan. There is another thing in the bill that allows for each plan to hire their own actuary, and in doing that, the plans feel that they will be more comfortable and maybe even more financially stable by working with their own selected actuaries. But they have also provided $140,000 for the pension commission to hire a actuary to be the check on their actuary. Article 12 talks about retirement savings programs in the and it revises PELRA law, Public Employees Labor Relations Act, to bargain, collect a bargain for the 403 vendors that are to be selected by the various governmental entities, and especially the teachers. And sections 2 to 5 allows MSRS to offer a Roth IRA or a Roth 457 and to serve as also in respect to those Roths that they will can offer. They can also give investment advice. Section 6 increases the maximum annual employer match from $2,000 to one half of the annual maximum allowable under the IRS code to a deferred compensation plan. And the IRS match is currently $7,750 and for those people under age 50 and $10,250 for those people over age. And the United Hospital District in Blue Earth is also able to contribute to deferred comp plans based on the PERA contribution rate. Article 13 talks about or institutes the PERA police and fire plan disability pension increase, corrects and it corrects an error that we made last year, or it makes a change that in the last year when we did a total revision of the police disability, police and fire disability, we inadvertently or advertently but lower the salary of some of the people that were receiving disabilities. And we don't want to do that. And this corrects that. It permits an additional benefit of 3% of salary for each year of service in excess of 20 years retroactive to 2007. And so people that were already receiving an amount will now can get that amount in the future, and we will pay them back. Article 14, local police and fire aid association changes, especially deals with Minneapolis firefighters and gives them an approximate one unit increase, which is about 1/40th of the salary of a top grade firefighter increase. When their association reaches 110% funding. they will be able to issue a 13th check. Article 15, some volunteer firefighter relief association changes that came about on the recommendation of a working group that was convened by the state auditor, and each of the working group's recommendations were submitted through the consensus process. There's none of the recommendations in section 1 through 11 had less than 100% consensus. The Article 16 has to do with a proposal that came from a labor organization that is willing to reimburse the pension fund for administrative expenses of setting up such a program and maintaining a program on the program on a yearly basis, in which the MSRS and PERA, but I think it's mostly MSRS, would be they would develop a plan in which the plan would deduct from their pension the dues that they pay to their union for their retirement union membership. And Article 17 are some small group provisions, Section 1 to 11. They are all individual or small group changes that were brought about by individual members of the legislature.
Questions, members? No questions. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment.
Pass out the amendment. Make sure the author of the bill has the amendment.
No, just the amendment.
Representative Murphy, have you seen this amendment?
I have seen this amendment.
Well, Representative Murphy, while it's being passed out, would you give us your reaction to the amendment?
It's fine, Mr. Chair. It's been the House position, but it did not. It was offered at the Pension Commission, and the Senate did not accept it. But the House supported it.
So, Representative Kahn, do you serve on the Pension Commission?
Yes.
And you offered it at the Pension Commission?
Yes.
And you couldn't get three senators to do it?
Right. But Mr. Chairman, may I explain the amendment?
Time.
Mr. Chairman, what this amendment does is add four members to the Pension Commission, assuring that at least one of those extra members is another minority member. The Pension Commission now has five members from each body, of which only one person is a member of the minority, which is correct when you look at the size of the majority minority, you know, a 3-2 ratio would not be appropriate. As you can see, I don't want to insult any of the members of this committee, but it's very difficult to understand pension issues. It's very difficult to understand them. When I became chairman of the committee that you are now chair of, Representative Pulaski and Representative Grayling and I were both put on the Pension Commission for the first time, and we served through this whole set of hearings. At one point, Mindy, we both had this feeling of hanging on with our fingernails, except I apparently hit it a little bit better, because at one point I asked a really stupid question, and Mindy Grayling said she had this great feeling of relief. And she said, Phyllis doesn't understand this any more than I do. She's just faking it better. and I just think having seven people in each body who go through these hearings and who can understand it, and having two members of the minority would be a big difference. We've had some discussions about the size of groups. I actually do have a paper which I think says that the ideal size of a group is 13-15 members, but the Senate doesn't quite believe that.
Is that biblical, or is that just...
No, it was a
something else.
It was a class and strategy in negotiation.
Well, I thought it might be something from the New Testament, but
no. The ideal numbers,
Well,
okay,
I can tell you, having just gone through the Passover Haggadah, we could say an awful lot about numbers. But 14, it only goes up to 13, I think. But
Representative Murphy, once again, what's your reaction to this amendment? You're very familiar with it. Do you wish this amendment to be put on?
Well, Mr. Chair, if we have, if this goes on, then we, and if the Senate has something go on that's different than ours, then we would have something to discuss in conference committee.
Representative Murphy, you may know that we have no members of the minority here at this time, and it's a rather curious or ironic amendment that we'd be offering without them being here.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I have discussed this with Steve Smith, the one minority member on the Pension Commission, and he has strongly supported it in the past. So,
it has been a House position, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any further discussion to the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Before Representative Murphy leaves, since we were earlier, as you heard, Representative Murphy, discussing some legislative reform, I'm wondering, since I'm relatively new here, the Pension Commission basically is a joint committee. Is that right?
That's correct.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Do you care to comment? I don't want to put you on the spot, but since you've been around here quite a while and since you heard us talking about legislative reform, can you comment on your thoughts in general about the propriety of a joint House-Senate committee? Not conference committees, but joint House-Senate committees like the Pension Commission. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Does it depend?
Mr. Chair, I think that with my experience on the Pension Commission, that it serves a very, very, the Pension Commission works very well, and it serves a very valuable purpose in that, as Representative Kahn said, there are very complex issues, and that affect people's lives forever. And the issues and the discussions in a regular House committee and the Senate committee, if they weren't separate, if they were separate, you would not hear the same thing at the same time from all the people that have to have input. And people that have, that we get a lot of input from, certainly is our staff. And secondly is the directors of the plan. And they have at their fingertips all the information that we have for our questions and answers kind of thing and making decisions. Very seldom does the Pension Commission make a decision on an item on one consideration. Almost every single item in here, and especially Article 1 and 2, have had numerous considerations, first consideration, second consideration, third consideration, the things that create major changes. Sometimes I heard for a 2-year period, and then the third or fourth year, we make the decision. And without continuity of the 10 or 14 people that would be hearing those things and working with those issues, I think we would make less intelligent decisions, and certainly we would have more mistakes, and that would be a bad thing for people's futures. I think that, though, that since you asked the question, I think that the Pension Commission members should be appointed immediately when we take office. And like last year, they were appointed till March, I think it was. The House people were appointed for a month earlier than the Senate, but there was no one to get together with. So last year's bill was kind of quickly put together.
Representative Murphy, you were not here for the hearings that we had, but one of the suggestions from NCSL was that actually to have us sworn in shortly after the election and then to move into our positions, and so that what we do then would be done in anticipation of going into session. And your remark would also add to that, that it would be helpful to have these people in their position, ready to go.
Right. That's an excellent idea, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kahn, I don't believe you moved the amendment. We're going to assume you moved the amendment when you passed it out, and then when we voted, we were actually voting on the movement of your amendment, which was the fact that you'd passed it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Representative Kahn.
Well, I think Representative Murphy wanted to say something. But...
I'm sorry, Representative Kahn, I think she was waiting for you.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, one of the things, besides the problem of the appointment, one of the changes that we actually did make in a committee like this on Pension Commission was to have one of the problems that helped that a little bit was at least to have the Pension Commission members serve until the new ones are appointed. So at least we could keep some continuity if people had still been had been reelected. But one of the things that I have suggested that we've never quite managed to do is to have the Pension Commission work the way the LCCMR works, which is doing all of its work in the interim, and people knowing that in order to have a bill passed in the Pension Commission, it has to be in before the session starts. And not through the last, you know, we were dealing with bills that had 3,000 and 4,000 numbers in the Pension Commission. The other problem that we've had, which Chan Murphy recognized, is that the Pension Commission doesn't get a scheduled time slot like committees do. And when you're dealing with the two bodies, it's incredible. Heroically tried to find meetings other than several all-night meetings practically through the term, but it's very hard to do that because of the absence of, the kind of recognition that a regular committee would have.
Thank you. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, if you care to comment, do you have any recommendation or even hunch about whether or not the model of the Pension Commission is something that would be a good idea to expand to other areas? In other words, front-loading rather than back-loading House-Senate collaboration on other issues? Or is that, is it kind of know it when you see it?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I would like to give that a little more thought, and I would think I would like to submit a couple of my observations in writing.
That would be appreciated, Representative Murphy. And Representative Kahn's comments would also, if you, both of you would do that, that would be very helpful.
And if, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
And if Representative Simon has any other questions that he would like included, get them to me.
Representative Kahn.
Chairman, I'll point out that several states, I know Connecticut and I believe Wisconsin, have joint budget committees, joint appropriations committees. And I think that's maybe one of the common joint committees that houses have.
Mm-hmm. That was brought up by Ms. Eric. Yeah. Any further questions on the bill? Is there anyone who wishes to testify on the bill in any way at this time? Somewhat amazing considering the interest in the bill prior to this hearing.
I know.
Mr. Chair, I understand.
Mr. Murphy.
I understand there's ongoing interest and there's ongoing work on a couple different provisions that meetings at a higher level than I are taking place.
Representative Murphy, I will renew my motion that House File 3082, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Rules Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Murphy.
Thank you so much.
Representative Morgan, you have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes of Wednesday, April 16th.
Representative Morgan moves the minutes.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, don't leave. We have one other testifier, Mr. Griffin. For those of you that were not here earlier, we had Pat McCormick testify from House Research, and some of you may want to get the information that Mr. McCormick gave us, particularly in reference to House File 1812. If we could have it quiet, please. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Mr. Griffin is testifying in reference to the discussion of the reform of the legislative process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I am appearing today as the Secretary of the Minnesota Governmental Relations Council. Founded in 1979, MGRC was created, quote, to promote and advance the ethical and professional standards of legislative representation. Our membership is comprised of 495 lobbyists working in Minnesota. MGRC would like to commend Chairman Pawlowski and the members of this committee for taking time to examine legislative process reform. While the subject may not generate media attention or public interest, it is very important. Our interest in improving the process stems from personal, professional, client, and public interest. Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, I will not reiterate a number of the possible suggestions presented by Ms. Erickson from NCSL in your previous hearings. There are a number of ideas that have been adopted in other states, and we would urge you to consider many of these in your future deliberations. Instead, I would like to offer several observations about the current legislative process in Minnesota. In short, Mr. Chairman and members, we have concerns about how the legislative process is being abused and the impact that this is having on the public's ability to follow and comment on proposed legislation. Let me explain by using some examples. An increasing amount of debate and action on legislation is moving from committee hearings to the House and Senate floors. Both the House and Senate have and should exercise their ability to debate legislation. But legislation is being amended substantially without the opportunity for public input. Bills are being introduced and adopted at record numbers without sufficient time or notice for public input. The House yesterday introduced House File 4217. 4,217 bills introduced in 2 years, and we aren't at the end of the session yet. Technology has provided the legislature with tools to open the process to the public through computers, television, and the internet. However, the use of these tools without discipline results in a process subject to observation, but not to examination or influence. I might add that influence is not a problem or a negative, it is a constitutionally protected right. Let me give you five quick examples from this session. Number one, the lack of public notice for committee hearings. Committee hearing notices are not being posted in a timely fashion. The agenda is being listed as, quote, to be announced. And then there's the famous agenda, or should I say infamous, House File XXXX. All of these examples leave the public and their representatives in the dark about the issues that are being presented.
Mr. Griffin, just I want to pause on House File XXX. This committee does not hear House File XXX. We consider them pornographic, so they're not. No, proceed.
Mr. Chairman, point well taken. And I shouldn't say these are applicable to this committee. This is talking about the process in general. All of these examples leave the public and their representatives in the dark about the issues being presented, discussed, and possibly acted upon at the hearing. Equally impossible to deal with is the constantly changing agenda. This session I received computer updates from a committee changing the agenda 5 times on the day of a hearing, including the final agenda that was updated just 45 minutes before that hearing took place. Number two, 45 minutes before that hearing took place. Number two, amendments in committee. House rules permit committee chairman to impose a 24-hour deadline for the filing of proposed amendments with the chair. These rules have not been enforced even when adopted, or if they are enforced, they have been done so unequally. On some bills, the 24-hour rule is in effect, and on others, it is not. Worse still is the use of the equally infamous delete all amendment. While there are circumstances when it is simpler for the committee and the public to deal with such an amendment, it is more often a mechanism used to avoid analysis and to further the efforts to change an author's position. For the first time this session, I witnessed an author bring a delete-all amendment to a committee hearing with an amendment to the delete-all amendment and an oral amendment to the amendment to the delete-all amendment. All of this after the bill had already been heard in another committee. Number three, unrealistic timelines or agendas. A 2-hour hearing with over 20 bills on the schedule is an announcement that the hearing is, quote, a rubber stamp, close quote, for bills, not a full hearing of the issues. Likewise, a two-hour hearing for a major bill may not be sufficient time to hear from the divergent sides of issues. It may only be possible for a chair to balance these extremes with years of experience and the wisdom of Solomon. But the legislature must work to better balance this equation. The number of bills that are being processed and the timelines for committees are resulting in increased amount of floor time in the activities described above. Committees are not being allowed the time to properly analyze and debate legislation. Number four, committee deadlines are not being enforced. Although we have passed committee deadlines, there are a large number of committees still meeting and passing deadlines well after the deadlines. Number five, the fiscal note process being ignored or bills being passed without fiscal notes. This is the first time I've seen a session in 31 years of experience of working at the state capitol where a fiscal committee has passed a bill where an agency has clearly stated it will have a fiscal impact and no fiscal note has been prepared. The committee passed the bill along without taking the fiscal note into impact into account. In this session, I've also seen an entire body pass legislation that has fiscal implications without fiscal notes in order. This is a dangerous precedent. Mr. Chairman and members, I would like to take more time to outline many of the other concerns with the process that we currently have, but please allow me just to make a couple of additional observations. The concerns raised above have been raised during this session. One staff person told me, Phil, this is the way things have always been. I would strongly disagree. In 4 years as a committee administrator for the House of Representatives, I submitted agendas on behalf of my chairs for next week's hearings that were followed. My committees never heard or scheduled a bill that had not been introduced. Agendas that ran long were carried over to another hearing, and deadlines were enforced. Observing and enforcing rules of process is in the best interest of the public and of our legislature. As lobbyists, we are here every day to follow the movement of legislation and last-minute changes. The public at large is not. It would be almost impossible to follow a piece of legislation from beginning to end this year, knowing when it has been heard, what it has been amended to, and who has spoken for or against it. Minnesota has a long and proud tradition of good legislative process. We continue to believe that Minnesota legislators share our goal of improving our government. While we do not know how you will proceed with these hearings on this subject, we would like to offer the assistance and expertise of our membership to you and in any future efforts you might make. Many of us love and respect this institution and look forward to working with you. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make one final statement. And while I'm sure MGRC would share my view, let me make it clear that these are my personal comments. And I'm sorry that my state legislator, Senator Anderson, isn't here because she spoke to the issue of taking sufficient time on the floor to debate many, many issues. But both Ms. Timmons and Mr. McCormick have been very polite and politic in making their comments to you. I will be more frank. One of the great assets of our legislature is your staff. To ask your staff to work under the pressure of time and workload of recent sessions is not only unfair, it borders on abuse. Good decision-making on your part cannot happen when you are sleep-deprived and working through the night's succession. Likewise, your staff cannot function at its best when they are being forced to staff your efforts. They are always here to prepare before you begin your work and to complete your work after you leave. My grandmother once said that nothing good ever happens after midnight. I would urge you and the members of the legislature to heed her words. Mr. Chairman and members, that concludes my testimony. I would be happy to take them, but I need to go to a...
Mr. Griffin, could you submit, I know you're reading it from your computer, if you'd email that to Mr. Malander and myself or the members of the committee, that would be appreciated. And I've got another request.
Please, sir.
This past week, we took up the education policy bill on the House floor. There were numerous amendments to that bill. You volunteered the help of your organization. It would be most helpful if the education lobbyists could provide to this committee the amendments that were offered and or adopted that were never introduced in bill form, never had a hearing in any body of or any committee of the House, and then suddenly are approved by the House and put into a omnibus education policy bill. That's just one committee. But if you have examples in other instances where this has occurred, because frankly in my time here, I haven't seen the quantity of amendments that were never introduced as bills appearing on the floor and then adopted, and with the potential, of course, the likelihood is that there will be vetoed, but that's no excuse, of becoming law, with no public input at all. No discussion, no debate, simply an idea. And in one case, one member apparently talking to the pages or the interns and then generating amendments from that discussion. If you could do that, that would also be very helpful.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'd be happy to.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions on a couple different things you mentioned. One is fiscal note. Could you talk about, based on, as you said, your 31 years of experience, this tension between, on the one hand, what you mentioned, not perhaps following fiscal notes, but on the other, let's face it, and I would imagine both parties, parties of both governors, yes, there have been DFL governors, even though it will have been 24 years since we elected one in 2010, sort of death by fiscal note, and real questions about the propriety of certain fiscal notes. And I want to be clear, I'd imagine in my short time here, most people strive to be accurate. But I think you would concede that at times, maybe it's a small minority of times, there has been real mischief with the fiscal note process. And if and when that happens, I can see where there are committee chairs who would say, to heck with it. This is a game, and who can play that game? Could you comment on that balance between, on the one hand, following a fiscal note if there is one and not simply ignoring it, but on the other, the very real frustration that I've heard senior members express about game playing with fiscal notes?
Mr. Griffin. Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I'm not naive enough to think that politics doesn't take place at the legislature. And in fact, it has a very good place at the legislature and should be used. On the other hand, there is a very strong tension between those two issues. Some legislatures have balanced that, as was cited earlier, in the state of Wisconsin by having a joint budget committee and trying to vet those things out in a little bit more open fashion. We struggle in healthcare almost daily with the issues of fiscal notes, particularly as they relate to my clients in the insurance world, where when the legislature is examining things like a new mandated benefit, and we are asked as groups who oppose those mandated benefits to help the state prepare those fiscal notes. We've suggested that it might be worth going to outside analysis to hire actuaries so that we get better, accurate information rather than us making up something. And in fact, 2 years ago, we suggested to the Department of Employee Relations that we no longer be a part of that process because the legislature didn't trust the numbers that we were bringing in. We still stand by them. I don't have any resolution for that other than to say that one of the abuses that I've seen this session that relates particularly to fiscal notes has been brought on by the fact that committees are trying to hear things at too late a date. So the particular abuse that I talked about, a bill was brought to the committee as an amendment. It was clearly a totally different bill and was added on at the last minute without the department having any opportunity to talk about what the fiscal analysis is. I don't have off the top of my head a solution to that problem, but I would like to continue to work with you to look at different ways of doing it.
First of the time, you had another question.
Just one follow-up, and this is maybe a hopelessly broad question, but I agree. It just seems to me, based on my short time here, that the amendment process on the floor is out of control, and I don't know who or what is to blame for that. But there's another tension here between an amendment process out of control and, I think, often cases, a sincere willingness by some members who perhaps don't serve on committees to have a voice. I know that the culture in the Senate, at least what I gather from my time here, is different, that the committee process is held in maybe a higher regard and that members largely defer to other members who sit on those committees. But I can understand the generic member of whatever party saying, look, I don't serve on the XYZ committee, and I'm not just going to magically defer to a member who sits on that committee to tell me what is best, and I have constituents and I have, you know, others who want me to weigh in on this on the House floor. I think that should be done sparingly. I think that should be done very rarely, but I can understand that member. Can you comment generally, either on your own behalf or on behalf of the organization, on that sort of tension between an amendment process that is absolutely out of control, that presses staff to the brink, and the right, perhaps, of a member to weigh in on something that isn't within his or her normal area of expertise?
That's Griffin.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, I think you're touching on what is perhaps one of the most difficult issues of representative democracy, and it goes back to what you and I studied as lawyers and political scientists. Where do you draw the line between using the expertise that you bring as a legislator to the process, your own opinions, and that of your constituents who you are supposed to be representing? And when I look at the amendment process on the floor, I think we've crossed way over the line using the expertise of individuals that might be there, the input that comes from the public and the committee process, and moving into a realm where we only take into account what an individual legislator's feelings have, or what an individual legislator's personal knowledge is bringing to an issue.
I would suggest to you that that is a very dangerous way to make laws. While many of you have expertise in a variety of areas, I don't think any of you carry to the floor the expertise necessary to carry to make decisions on the vast array of legislation in the vast subject areas that you are trying to deal with. And I would hope that your membership would look very carefully and closely at that process and say that we may have crossed the line in terms of how representative democracy really ought to work.
Representative Cox.
Mr. Chairman, Phil, could you comment on one of the things which I think we should graph it? I think it's got to be a steadily increasing line, numbers of committees, and how you think that works on the process.
Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that a great deal of the difficulty that we have this session is the vast number of committees. Most legislatures, as you heard Ms. Erickson say, have limitations on the number of committees that you can serve on. It is impossible for you to be at all of these committee hearings and get any other work done. And I do believe that there is a lot of other work that legislators need to do besides just attend committee hearings. I'm not sure how we divide those committees up. It used to be a fairly long-standing process that we had an Ag committee and an Education committee and a Health and Welfare committee in my days. Those stood for a long time. We've, I think, expanded those to take into account trying to spread the wealth of committee chairmanships in a political fashion, but I'm not sure that it served us in a really good policy fashion.
Representative Kahle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Griffin, one of the frustrations that I have as a newcomer and also that I've heard from my constituents that I think you spoke to is the ability to track individual bills that get rolled in as provisions into omnibus bills. And I'm wondering if, and I have some thoughts myself, obviously training in architecture, I jump to solving problems very quickly. I'm wondering if you have some thoughts, if you share that frustration as a longtime lobbyist and participant in the process, and if you have any thoughts and advice to this body that we might recommend to make the public, make it more accessible to the public as we do that.
Mr. Chair, I have one quick thought, but I think it's the double-edged sword for the lobbyist. The amendment is one of those things that we love to use and often is used to do things that we can't do in other fashions, namely introducing a bill and getting it hurt. That being said, I think it really is a dangerous way to go, and I think one of the best things that we can use is this tool that I have in front of me, a computer. If we tracked all of our omnibus bills and every amendment that went through this process on the computer systems that the reviser has, which they do track, but open that up to the public, you could actually follow what was being happened as a bill is introduced or as an amendment is introduced. Put that in the computer system and you can know. That is a really difficult situation, and especially when we start dealing with, as I've dealt for the last 15 years, omnibus health and human services bills that run in the 300, 400, 500, or 600 page level. It's very difficult to spend hours doing it. My clients, two of them, the health plans, we have a group at the Minnesota Council of Health Plans we call our Legal and Regulatory Subcommittee. It's made up of 14 lawyers, and I can tell you they spend most of Monday afternoon every week trying to analyze what's gone into bills and what's gone out of bills, and it is a nightmare. But I think the reviser number in amendments can be used so that we can pull together what's there and follow more clearly what's going on. I would commend the legislature for our legislative websites. These have made our jobs tremendously easier and have made it much easier for me to get information to my clients and to the public and to people who call me and say, what's going on with the bill over the legislature? But until we tie them all together and say, this is really what's going on, or we go back to what used to happen, which was we passed individual bills on the floor, not rolling everything into an omnibus bill, we're going to still suffer that consequence of difficulty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Griffin, I'm glad you mentioned the reviser reviser number for the amendment, because I think that's part of that was one of the things that I think I'm very sympathetic to Ms. Anderson and all of her colleagues, our CLAs, that are having to chase their tails often by the workload and the schedule that we have. But I think those reviser numbers could be used to connect to, or to aggregate into, I'm using the wrong term here, so someone else, and sorry, Representative Winkler isn't here, but I think a jump link might be the term that you could actually follow and you know, jump into that exact location in the omnibus bill. So if you were tracking an individual bill that then got rolled in, and you could use that, somehow create a jump link, so then you could then find it in the omnibus bill. I think we do the same thing very nicely with roll call votes on amendments on the floor that you can track, but I think that this might be one way to make it much more accessible for the public. I do think that omnibus bills are appropriate ways to go on the floor as a newcomer, but I think as long as you can actually track what's in them.
President Tuck.
Mr. Chairman and members, anyone who wants to condemn omnibus bills, I'll just refer you to something which was actually, I think, one of my better contributions to the legislative process. Again, when I chaired the Government Operations Committee, look at the memo that you have from Representative Murphy from the omnibus pension bill. I was the person who came up with the concept of an omnibus pension bill, and before that, every single one of these bills would have been heard individually, in not only in the Pension Commission, but then in committee, and passed individually on the floor of the House. I mean, even if they're considered trivial. And one of the things that happens with that is, of course, every one of them is then germane to amendments of any size and any length that have anything to do with pensions. So just imagine the time that we spend today on the omnibus pension bill, and imagine that divided into the 39 separate bills and amendments that are listed.
But Representative Tom, that bill was put together in the Pension Commission. Those bills were heard individually,
and it
wasn't that it was just slapped together. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you know, a little bit of medicine does help a person, but if you drink the whole bottle, oftentimes
we just drink the whole bottle.
I think we're drinking the whole bottle. Or Kool-Aid, yeah. Maybe that's a better word. I'm not sure, but
no.
Representative Simon,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we're up against time,
we're not. We have the Senate coming in at 10 for a conference committee that will be here. So, and we have Representative Morgan's on that conference committee. I am Representative Broad. I hope will be here. And so, no, that's fine.
Well, and
Representative Simon,
and tell me, Mr. Chair, my tender feelings won't be heard if this is something that we should be having offline. But since we have Mr. Griffin here, I'd like to take advantage of his expertise.
This chairman, it's a 9:30 conference committee, so I don't
expect
to be starting for
on Senate time.
I'm just trying to think through the cause and effect here, and I know that one of the reasons that we had something like House File 1812, and one of the reasons for omnibus bills in general, is the out-of-control amendment, what I at least think, and I know I'm putting my thumb on the scale here, but is an out-of-control amendment process. And I think part of the thinking was, I don't think I'm giving away any great strategic insight here, is look, if we're going to have an out-of-control 60 or 70 amendment floor session, that we might as well get it all over and have one, rather than having seven. Because the same amendments are going to come up on all these bills, and it's going to be a lot of ha-ha fun and getting people on bad votes and dozens of amendments. And so that, I'm thinking, I'm not saying it was the right decision. I think arguably it was not the right decision. But at least the decision makers had on their minds that, look, if we're going to have this mischief on the floor, then let's have one really bad 10-hour, 12-hour session rather than seven. And maybe that was the wrong call. But I guess the question I'm asking you is, what do you think about either limitations on numbers of amendments or limitations on overall debate on a bill? If we were to say on a big bill, hey, you got 6 hours on this bill, not 10, not 12, not 14, or if we were to say somehow some number of amendments, do you think that is efficient? And even if it is efficient, is it fair? Because I've been in the minority too, just for one term, and one term now in the majority. And I understand, and I don't think we should be muzzling the minority, because the minority needs an outlet for their ideas, and that is fair. Could you comment generally, that was a meandering way of asking you this question, what do you think about time limits or amendment number limits?
Mr. Chairman, let me be specific that I'm speaking for myself and not on behalf of NPRC. I don't think that there is any problem with limiting debate, either on the floor or in committee. We do it all the time in committee, in saying to both sides of an issue, we only have X amount of time to handle a bill. I think that it would be wise of the legislature to move towards those kinds of limitations. You're correct that we need to be careful of the tyranny of the majority, but I don't think that anything is gained by ad nauseum debate. In fact, I think if members were required
to limit not only their testimony but the number of amendments that were offered. It would require them to take more time in making sure that the arguments that they were making were ones that were very succinct and were clear and were important to them. I don't know how to describe what is going on the floor of the House these days, but I can tell you that this session has been very unusual for me. I'm happy that my children are older. I have a photo on the piano that Tom Olmscheid took of me outside the hearing room with my one-year-old and two-year-old. They're now 18 and 16. At a late night when my wife was sick and I was here at all hours of the night with a committee hearing and had no choice but to bring them over. But that happened one time in my first many years of lobbying. I have not left here before midnight on the first four Monday nights of this session. I had not left here before 10 o'clock at night on the rest of the Monday nights. We were in tax committee again last night. And that kind of process, I don't think, works to help the system. And I think the limitation of debate, the ideas that Ms. Erickson gave you on limiting the number of bills that are introduced, I'll point to Chairman Pawlowski behind him sits for the statutes. There were four volumes, including the index, when I started here. I can't see, but I believe we're at 16 now, if I remember correctly. And I know that we have passed some good laws, but it's similar to what my uncle used to say, who was a surgeon. If you're a patient and you go to a surgeon, his recommendation is going to be to cut. That's what he's been taught to do. Legislatures pass bills. That's what we're taught to do. But we need to be careful of how we do that process, and I think limitations are a good idea.
Members, remember that House File 1812, if it was devised to avoid the individual debate, is now being taken apart so that we can have the individual debate, so we're going to do it twice. They're certainly, if they caught someone, they apparently caught themselves. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a question for Mr. Griffin and Representative Fineman, or a thought about whether the you squeeze a balloon and problems show up elsewhere. I'm thinking about Congress, where testimony even in or questions by members in committee even is limited, and I wonder if, yes, it does cause one to sharpen arguments in your 5 minutes questioning the nominee for the Supreme Court, let's say, but I wonder if it doesn't force some of more of that deal making and discussion to happen behind closed doors in a less transparent way. And I wonder if that might be if even Representative Simon might have some thoughts if that might be a move that would decrease transparency and openness rather than increase it.
Does anybody want to respond to that?
I was wondering, Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon.
Well, Representative Simon might want to.
No, actually, Mr. Chair, I would. I'm not quite sure I understood the question, but I.
And these questions might be better left when we begin to take a look at what we're going to do for recommendations. We do have one other person who wishes to testify.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond quickly to Representative Gillen. I would not recommend the congressional model of the direction that we move. We do have difficulty, but I continue to believe that this is a pretty good process. And as somebody who's worked for a large international corporation in many other states, I covered 27 states at one time. We have a great deal to be proud of here, and I wouldn't suggest we throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I do think we have an opportunity for a great deal of improvement, and I'm delighted and offer again our assistance in trying to work with you and the chairman to move in that direction.
Mr. Griffin, your comment about your grandmother and midnight, I think you were here when Ms. Erickson was going through the recommendations, and there are many states where in their rules there is only one rule that cannot be suspended, and that is the rule that says you cannot go past midnight. We regularly suspend that rule. So your grandmother was very wise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have one other person who wishes to testify. Mr. Davies, you want to come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you. I'm Jack Davies, a former state senator and former judge and former professor, I guess. I don't see any students, I don't think. There's always one in the room. I gave you a memo a couple weeks ago that I hope caught your interest. There was not much philosophy in that, and I thought maybe I'd just take a minute or two and give you some philosophy that I thought was came to my mind as I listened to the witnesses this morning. The fact of so many bills being introduced and so many bills being introduced indicates to me that there's a lot of work to do. Now, the only way to do a lot of work is to divide the work. You just can't do as much work as you're doing with big committees. So what you need is smaller committees. But more importantly, you need subcommittees. Now let me give you this point of view. When any of you decide that a bill should be introduced and drawn or drafted addressing a particular subject matter, you have only your own talents as you give the instruction to the reviser, and you only have one reviser's usefulness as they shape that bill. So the bills come in, frankly, they have to, inevitably, half-baked. Now, how do you shape the bill so that the committee's time is wisely spent? And I think you do that by using the subcommittee on almost every bill. I got to tell you, when I was chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, we hardly ever had a bill that came before the full committee that had not run through one of the three drafting, standing subcommittees that I established. Now, the way people got in those subcommittees was interesting. I checked out their other committee schedules, and anybody who was free at a particular hour got on that subcommittee, so I was not competing with their schedule. But I really think that you just have to, in everything you do, divide the labor and emphasize the committee. Now, the more work that's done in a subcommittee with a minority member and in the committee with minority members' impacts, inputs, the less attention there will be, or less temptation there will be to offer amendments on the floor. Now, I got to tell you, politically, those harmful votes that the minority is always looking for these minority members, all you need is one to defeat somebody. You don't need 10. So, anyway, that's all I wanted to emphasize, and I'm ready for questions if you want to take
any questions. Thank you.
But thank you very much for your interest. I'll be watching through the summer as you're...
I'm sure you'll be back. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Seeing no more discussion, and we don't have any other... Morgan, you're out of motions today?
I'm out of motions.
You're out of motions, right. I'm going to adjourn the committee, and then we will be going back into this committee at whatever time we have available, and I don't know what that's going to be over the next couple of weeks, and then over the interim. So we will. Rep. Sam Peterson.
What's your idea of the process that we will follow that we've had this discussion? Where do we go with it?
I would like to have the committee come back as a standing committee and start to discuss what we would make as recommendations for the next legislative session. And that what this it would be from both sides of the aisle. So, and I would hope we could come to some agreement that these are recommendations of this committee. There are other members who wish to sit in, and I would encourage other members of the body to sit in as we proceed. Yeah. Representative Simon.
Sorry, just a logistical question. So you envision having one or more than one hearing actually here during the interim?
Yes, more than one, probably.
Okay.
We have to.
Yeah. Can we leave our...
Yes, if you would leave those in the in your folders, we'll just keep referring to them rather than having to reprint these. So the NCSL and any other documentation dealing with this, and particularly if you've marked it up, I've made copious notes on mine that I'd like to refer back to. So with that, meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.